Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table and talk about God, Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects with really fascinating people. I would like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you who are joining me for the third season of Context Matters, and a special shout out to people like David and Michelle Kaufman, who are on my Patreon team. It is this team that makes the podcast sustainable, so thanks to all of them for getting us to season three. This week, we dive into issues related to the environment. I am one of those people who finds great solace in being outside, surrounded by flowers, mushrooms, trees, and colorful clouds. Granted, winter is hard, but the parks in Philadelphia saved me during this pandemic. The thoughts or experiences that most drastically altered my spiritual growth happen outside, on mountains, on trails, or as I stared at the night sky and threw my fists in the air to dare God to engage me. I've watched as my younger nephews and nieces more eagerly engage issues about water conservation or recycling than most of the people do in my generation. I deal with the necessity of caring for the earth when I teach on the book of Deuteronomy, because that message is so clear and unambiguous. But I watch people tune out, or they say that applied only to ancient people, not to us. Or they mumble something about a new heaven and a new earth and shake their heads with pity at me. So I brought in a scholar I've known for ages, one who has helped shape me as an academic, and one who recently published a book titled Stewards of Eden, What Scripture Says About the Environment and Why It Matters. I am honored to introduce you to Dr. Sandy Richter, who is the Robert H. Gundry Chair of Biblical Studies at Westmont College in Santa Barbara. She has a crazy busy schedule teaching, filming Bible studies, writing, and leading trips to Israel. So I am so pleased she carved out time to join all of us here at the podcast table. We've known each other for a while, but I've always known you as a professional, as Professor Dr. Sandra Richter. But what was it earlier in your life? What actually prompted you to study biblical studies as a profession instead of just something that was a hobby or in church?
So after all the years we've known each other, be surprised you don't, we haven't had this conversation yet.
I know.
What got me into biblical studies was getting saved is what got me into biblical studies. So I was raised in a marginally Catholic household. I really had never engaged my own. And in my late teens, someone shared the gospel with me, radically changed my life. I had a throw you down, change your life conversion story. That was the first big change. And because my family also was pretty fractured, I didn't have any guidance for my future. Somewhere in the midst of this little house church that I was a member of, and I was raised Catholic in a Jewish neighborhood, so I didn't even know Protestants existed. I didn't know the church was out there. I didn't know there were missions organizations. I didn't know anything. Somebody dropped the book, The Cross and the Switchblade, into my hands. And I don't know how or where or when. I was reading the story about David Wilkerson and his response to the heroin crisis in New York City. And that's how Teen Challenge was born. The Holy Spirit just used it in my life, grabbed hold of my heart. I couldn't sleep at night. I went to one of the elders in my little house church and I said, okay, I read this book. I can't sleep at night. I have to find these people. I have to help them. And she said to me, oh, well, what you're experiencing is a call to ministry. And I said, oh, okay, what's that? And she said, well, it means you need to go to a Bible college. And I said, oh, okay, what's that? And she knew of two, Christ for the Nations and Valley Forge Christian College. So I applied to both of them in crayon. And apparently Christ for the Nations lost my application. Valley Forge accepted me. I went there sight unseen. And I spent every summer in college working in the Philadelphia Teen Challenge Women's Home, the induction center down in Germantown, which was hugely formative. You know, was a pretty straight arrow kid. I'd never even been drunk, let alone high. And here I am holding the hand of addicts as they go cold turkey through the middle of the night. It was fabulous. We saw miracles left and right. After that, I went into ministry. And as we are both very familiar with, women in ministry are often just a touch controversial. And I was in a really conservative group that was afraid of women and was afraid of academics. And so I was the perfect storm. And I very quickly realized that although I had loved my years at Valley Forge, I was woefully underprepared for ministry. So I wound up in a youth pastor position in Western Mass, knew that Gordon Conwell was on the coast. And so I started commuting the 2.5 hours when I could to take classes to help expand my skill set. And as most undergraduate programs are all New Testament, I wanted to fill out the story. So I started taking all the Old Testament classes I could. I started taking Hebrew. Gary Pratico was my first Hebrew teacher, and I loved every minute of that class. And then I was also taking growth in the small church, how to deal with problem people, that and the other thing.
You're like, and this applies to me exactly right now.
Yeah. In the midst of my experience at Gordon Conwell, which at the time was very reformed and also really challenged with women in leadership, I just got used to being the odd man out. God just, he redirected me. And there are many stories that go with that as well, but he just sovereignly said, turn left at the next stop sign. And the turn left involved my application to Harvard University, where to my surprise, because again, I come from a pretty dicey background. Here I am, an incoming PhD student in the Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations Department. So that's the short version.
Dr. Richter, you are an East Coaster in yes. So many ways. You have East Coast running through your veins. You have now taught at two different Southern universities. Mm-hmm. And you taught at a Midwest university, and mm-hmm. you're now on the West Coast. So as someone, like, I'm so fascinated with geography, and I'm just curious if, as you've moved around, have you noticed how the geography, even within the United States, is forming your students differently so that they're asking different questions about God, or so that your own scholarship maybe is changing? Have you noticed that happening at all?
So much. In some ways, it's really amusing because we are one country, right? This is the United States of America, and we're all Americans and we all speak English. And honestly, in my travels through this country, I feel like I'm crossing borders into almost different nationalities. And the other thing that just makes me laugh periodically is that nobody realizes that the other guy exists. In fact, one of the institutions I taught in, as you know, is an inner city seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. So you cannot get any more old South than Jackson, Mississippi. And this was a big cultural reach for me because I did not know that there is a difference between the deep South and the South. So you just spoke of me having taught at two Southern institutions. And one of them was Asbury Theological, which is in Lexington, Kentucky. That is a whole different country than Jackson, Mississippi. And the rules of engagement, the rules of courtesy, it's a whole different world. And especially as this past year has gone on and so many political issues in particular have just splattered across our headlines. And the people in my current region, Southern California, cannot understand how anyone in the world could have commitments, to be blunt, that could get Donald Trump into office, where other parts of the country cannot fathom how people in Southern California could be 65% Democratic in their vote, whereas the rest of the country is 49-50, 49-51. Yeah. I feel like a sojourner on a regular basis. So yeah, definitely geography, weather makes a huge difference. Are you outside most of the time? Are you inside most of the time? Attitudes toward what education should look like, shaped largely on climate. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. I've started bringing in some of those issues of weather in my classes on geography. Because I, when I show pictures to people of warm climates, I'm like, what do you think they think about time? And they're like, oh, it's laid back. It's a little fuzzier. Like, it's true. It changes our perspective. And it's not just how we culturally live life, but it also is what we think we need from God in those as well, which
That's interesting.
I think is.
Yeah, I find the work ethics and hours that people spend in the office are really shaped by weather. And I also find social bonding, community bonding is shaped by weather as well. I would find places where there's lots of snow and lots of ice, there's much more of what I would call the Protestant work ethic, you know, pedal faster, going to bed early to rise makes man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Whereas when it's absolutely gorgeous outside all day, every day, there's much more of a work to live posture as opposed to live to work posture. And then like in Mississippi, where for 6 months out of the year, if you step outside, you'll melt. There's actually a lot more, at least in our neighborhood, you know, people went from one air conditioned setting to another, and it was much harder to just have conversations in your front yard. Yeah, it's really intriguing.
Now, since we're talking about weather, because we're going to be talking about a biblical perspective of environmentalism, and I'm just curious if this is my bias, because I love and adore the book of Deuteronomy, just like you. I kind of walk in your footsteps after you in that regard. You did your PhD in Deuteronomy. You've done several provocative writings on the book of Deuteronomy, like the economy in Deuteronomy, which is so fun. Do your environmental concerns come out of the creation care laws that you see in Deuteronomy? Or is that my bias because I think everything comes from Deuteronomy? Is your interest actually a little bit wider than just that one book?
I would say my interest is wider than the one. My history with environmental concern really predates my Christian commitments. I have always been an outdoors person like you are. I've always loved the backcountry, the ocean, the mountains, very high level of appreciation for habitat and high level of empathy and wonder and awe for the wild creature in its habitat. That's always been a part of who I am. But as I talk about in the book, once I became a Christian, I honestly didn't think I was allowed to prioritize those loves, those loves for God's amazing creation, what a theologian would call general revelation. And I tell a story in the book, in particular, when I was teaching at Wheaton, where Kristen Page, their endowed chair biologist, and I crafted a course on Christian stewardship and environmentalism from a Christian perspective. And we put together this first ever class for Wheaton College. And we had about 25 students enroll the first time around. And you, I'm sure, have made use of this icebreaker before yourself. We just opened the class and wanting to help build a little bit of community in the classroom. There were only 25 students. We asked everyone, okay, let's go around the room and tell us who you are, what your major is, and why you decided to take this course. Well, Kristen and I were stunned because each student, as we went around the room, every one of them told the same story. And it was the story I just told you, that all of my life, I have loved God's creation. I'm a bird watcher. I'm a sailor. I love the Ozarks, the wild ponies on Assateague, you know, fill in the blank. But I did not realize that as a Christian, I was allowed to love the gospel and love the planet at the same time. And I'm so glad you offered this course. Every one of them. And when we got around the room and I turned to Kristen and she turned to me, we had the exact same story. So for me, this has been kind of an evolution of realizing that these two loves do cohabit and that our rule of faith and praxis, our Bible, speaks to the stewardship of this planet and the love for this planet on pretty much every page. And of course, we got a lot going in Deuteronomy, but it's all over the text.
It is. And it's so fascinating to me that within churches, and this goes for geography, everything related to geography. So then also the land and care for the land and behavior among the geography, which we both love because we have this in common as well. But those issues seem to be like the no-go zone in churches. And I mean, a lot of people who listen to this podcast are in the United States, but not everyone is, but in the United States anyway, and in Canada to a certain extent, environmentalism is so tied up in politics that we forget it's a biblical concept that we should be talking about. But people don't want to go there because they don't want to align themselves or misalign themselves with any political stance. So how do you even get beyond the first mental barrier that people have to pick up a book that is specifically saying we are Christian, evangelical, we're going to talk about the environment?
And you've tagged it, you know, absolutely nailed it. I introduced the book with 3 points that answered the question, how is it that the church, the historical moral compass of society, and at our best, that is who we are. How is it that the church has gone missing in action on this critical issue? And the answers I offer, the first one is the political one. And it's American politics, by the way. It's not European politics. I was at the London School of Theology this time last year, and I was asked to give a lecture on my current research, which the book was just releasing. So I gave a public lecture, and the title was, Can a Christian Be an Environmentalist? And all the Brits were like, why are you even asking that question? Of course a Christian can, should, must be an environmentalist. So it's not European politics, it's American politics. And in American politics, as we know so well, if you are pro-life, you supposedly cannot also be pro-environment. If you are a patriot, you cannot be a conservationist. In other words, if you're a Christian, you can't be a Democrat. And the Democrats are the ones who support the environmental agenda. And somehow or another, environmentalism has been pigeonholed into a particular political agenda and has become guilty by association. Now, I'm sure you've got people on your podcast who are screaming right now, I'm a Democrat and I'm a Christian, and more power to you. But we all know that this false dichotomy exists. So the number one reason, number two, I think, is that we, especially the Western elite, we don't see the impact of environmental degradation, particularly upon the widow and the orphan. We do not see the 90% deforestation in Madagascar that is starving out the Malagasy people. We don't see happening in Haiti with floods and mudslides, again, because of deforestation. We don't look out our front windows and see the impact of mountaintop removal coal mining. We don't see it. And so we, who would normally be deeply invested in the welfare of the widow and the orphan, don't realize that environmental degradation is destroying these people's lives. So two, we don't see it. And then third, we've got this theological problem, which there are a lot of people out there that are teaching that the New Testament teaches that the earth is going to burn. So we need to worry about it. We just need to get to what really matters, which is saving souls.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that later, because I hear people, and people have come back to me after talks and have gone, but there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. Like, what's your issue? I'm like, we have to live here. One, and two, your comment already is bad theology.
Well, there is going to be a new heaven and a new earth, which should show the response of Christian how profoundly God values this creation. And we, especially as evangelicals, you know, especially as, you know, kind of the offspring of the Baptist movement, we tend to think about redemption, about redemptive history, about God's plan of salvation as nothing more than personal fire insurance, right? get as many people to the altar as possible, get them stamped with the you won't burn, and we've done our job. Whereas the entire biblical witness is that God is not simply saving individuals. He is saving people to occupy a resurrected planet to get back to the original plan, which is what that humanity, as those made in God's image, as stewards of all of his good creation, would finally be able to get around to doing what Adam and Eve were commissioned to do in the garden. So all that to say, yeah, there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. And you know what? There's going to be a new humanity as well. But we're all going to be resurrected, not recreated. And what does that say to us?
So I brought up a subject I have been considering in more areas than just the environment, but which seems to be very appropriate here. It is the issue of belonging to a place versus owning the place. I was thinking of the creation narrative in Genesis 1 in particular, and how God formed places first, then he filled the places with what flourished in that place. Think sky, sea, and land that are filled with stars, fish, and then beasts and humans. With the work I've done on ancient Israelite living in the land, as it is depicted in the Bible, I keep seeing how people belong to a place or in a place. They take care of the place, and that place shapes them. Things seem to go topsy-turvy when we get into our heads that nature is a commodity to be exploited, to own, or to consume however we want. In my conversation with Dr. Richter, I mentioned the example of the Europeans coming to claim the land in the Americas, in contrast to the indigenous Americans who lived with great respect towards all of creation. So, what is the Bible's perspective for how humans interact with the environment and the land?
Right. And I love the work that you've done on place. In fact, I just gave you a big plug in my Psalms curriculum, by the way.
So
I think I would ask you in response a question that I think that the abuse of the land, using it as opposed to partnering with it, I think it's way older than the Europeans. I mean, we can go back to the law code. Robbie and his truncation of the fallow law because he wanted to get more out of the land. And many people would argue that the salination of the fertile fields of what used to be Eden and is now Iran and Iraq is from human civilization and overuse and abuse. Do you see this just as that shift from tribal to bureaucratic, that a tribal society honors its land more highly than a bureaucratic society does?
People who live so closely to the land, I think they intuitively understand there's parts of nature they can't necessarily control. But the more they get to know it, the more they can work with it, and the land will support them. When those interests become larger, more bureaucratic, as you said, more nation-driven, I think the nations, the bureaucracy, can see either one, the land becomes a commodity, or two, we can destroy the people on the land by destroying what is holding them up, which is the land.
One of the quotes that I closed the book with is coming from a fellow named Gus Speth, who had been a major player in environmental politics all the way back to Jimmy Carter's administration. But let me read this quote for you. Gus Speth, chairman of the Council of Environmental Quality under Jimmy Carter, and he makes this statement at the end of his career. I used to think that the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that 30 years of good science could address these problems. I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with these, we need a cultural and spiritual transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. I hear that quote and I respond with, put me in, coach. I know how to deal with that. The church knows how to deal with that. That's who we are. We're the moral compass of society. We can change that. So one of the quotes that I repeat throughout the book, I have a little proverb, which is, the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. He's given it to us to use in our need, but not to abuse in our greed. And I am completely convinced, and I think Gus Speth is as well, that the reason we have an environmental crisis has nothing to do with need. It has to do with greed. It has to do with abuse. It has to do with the earth as a commodity, as you're speaking of. And so what I challenge the reader to do in my little book is to let's dial this all the way back to our rule of faith and praxis. What does our Bible tell us about our relationship with the planet? Does our Bible champion a tribal society over bureaucratic society? Does our Bible champion the indigenous Americans over the Europeans? Does our Bible speak to those issues? And I would say it does. But essentially, what our Bible communicates loud and clear is that the Creator entrusted this planet to a steward. That steward is man and woman, Adam and Eve, made in his image, which is unique throughout the entire biblical witness. And as those made in his image, we have been entrusted with this amazing cosmos, this fierce and fragile ecosystem that is populated by creatures beyond our imaginations that depend on the flora that is dependent on the ecosystems. And it's our job to make sure that these things flourish. That's what the Creator handed off to Adam and Eve in the very beginning. And that's the message of Genesis 1 and 2 in the creation narrative. And what we see in that relationship is that this planet, this place, as you're saying, is not ours. We don't own it. But under the authority of the Creator, it's our job to steward it. And that's where I think the rub comes. And the rub for fallen humanity. Oh, no, this is mine. I can use it up as I wish. And I would say the rub for redeemed humanity as well, that somehow or another, that stewardship message has gotten lost in our gospel. And it's lost in the gospel.
I am curious what your thoughts are on this issue. You are welcome to contact me through my website, narrativeoplace.com. Thank you for being a part of this podcast experience. As always, it is wonderful to sit and exchange ideas with you here at the virtual table. If you want to be a part of the Patreon team who makes this podcast sustainable, you will find a link in the episode notes of the show. The talented Peter Lawrence of Sycamore Sound created all of the music you hear. I look forward to our conversation next week. So until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.